tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, Drowning Sins in Tooth Decay. She's a Lovatarian. One foot in the grave and the other in a banana peel. In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Doug Cooper. I'm joined tonight by T.
Howdy, everybody.
And I'm joined with a very serious and grave-looking Jonathan J.M. Rowe. Gravitas.
Hello, Tapsters. I'm just tired.
It's been a while since we've gathered together.
Yes. We have not vinyl tapped in quite some time. Yep. There were Tony's in the middle of session right now. Those of you who live outside of Texas, Texas was wise enough to keep their legislature from meeting every year. They only meet every other year, so they're limited in the amount of mischief they can cause.
Yeah, they still cause a lot of mischief, though.
But when they meet a lot, and Tony's wrapped up into that, creating laws to protect us from ourselves. And also, I have just come out of the COVID fog. So my first experience with COVID, it was not pleasant, but I feel like I've helped science. There were rumors going around that high tea was preventative of COVID, and a lot of people didn't take proper precautions because of those rumors, and now that I've had it, everybody knows that's not true.
So, or it could just be that you don't have high tea.
That's funny, T. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we're very excited to be here tonight. We're talking about an album I never heard of before until Power Pop Tony put me onto it. And that album is called Spilt Milk by the band Jellyfish from the year 1993.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Early 93, yeah.
This is deep inside tea territory. And this is when I was in hibernation, so I have not ever heard this album or any Jellyfish albums until T brought them up. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're like me, I think you're in for a surprise tonight. I always start out with a question. T?
Yeah, Doug?
How come this album and not Belly Button?
Well, we were just talking briefly before we started about how Belly Button gets a bit of a short end of the stick when it comes to the two albums this band put out, only two. Spilt Milk is a masterpiece, in my opinion. I guess that's a bit of a spoiler alert about what my rating is going to be. This hits me in all my sweet spots. It's power pop, but it's power pop that is... I think there's a direct line to, and I don't want to get into what you're going to do, so just bear with me for a minute. There's a direct line to, in particular, McCartney-era Beatles and solo McCartney stuff. I think people talk about power pop, and they talk about Jangle the Birds, whatever, but there's also this lineage that goes from the Abbey Road, second side of Abbey Road, and I think this is tied directly to that with a bunch of other stuff sprinkled in.
Yeah.
It's got queen-like harmonies. I mean, harmonies galore, and they're intricate and they're fantastic. The lyrics are really great. I mean, this is not your everyday power pop band in terms of girl meets boy, girl loves boy, whatever, boy mm-hmm. loves girl.
I'm not even sure that we have a single example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's bouncy when it needs to be. It's crunchy when it needs to be. It's melancholy when it needs to be. It is a smorgasbord for the ears. And I want to say I never get bored listening to this album, ever get bored listening to it. And I think this band had a motto when they went into the studio. It's kind of a silly motto, but it's one they held very dear. And I think this album proves it, which is all killer, no filler. This album is that to a T.
Yeah.
You know, plus, that saying is not as clever as they are.
Yeah,
exactly. It surprises me a little that's what they were saying. It's true, but it does surprise me that.
And then finally, I want to say they're very similar to, I would put them in the same camp as somebody like Big Star. This band put out two albums, and they have influenced, they weren't very commercially successful, but they've influenced so many power pop bands after them. Nobody even comes close to sounding like them, but there's so many bands that want to, that what they produce is pretty great in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So that's why this album, mainly the band, but this album in particular showcases all of those things.
So Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Yes.
By my estimation, you had been out of high school for about 8 years when this album came out.
I believe that's correct. Yes.
And you were probably in love with some girl.
When is he not in love with some girl?
He's in love with the girl he's been talking about.
I think I was about to fall out of love with a girl.
Well, that's a bad time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
God, please stop. Please stop.
Were you very familiar with this album?
I was not familiar with this album. I was familiar with the band. I've had this conversation with Tony before. In fact, when Tony, I guess Tony, we've known each other
19 years.
Ages our kids. And almost immediately upon meeting Tony and we figured out we had a kinship for music, he mentioned Jellyfish.
I don't remember band. That, but
I do.
I think he mentioned him when I met him for the first time.
I
didn't even know he was married and had kids before I knew he liked Jellyfish.
The band I'd seen on MTV when Belly Button came out, and I was kind of off put by their vibe. I thought that they did it. I've told Tony this story. They did an interview where they were dressed like
Dr. Seuss
something
characters.
Out of like. H.R. Puff and Stuff characters.
Yeah.
And one was holding a big lollipop, and I was just, this is just ridiculous. But, and then they played the music, and I thought the music was good, but I was just like, I was kind of like you, Doug. I was going through kind of my hibernation period as well, musically. And I just wasn't into anything that MTV was playing. But I do remember kind of liking their song thing. It was a pop number, and I went, this is different than all the hair metal crap that's coming out right now.
It's probably The King Is Half Undressed is what I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think that is it.
That's the first time I saw him as well.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, I just saw the album cover and I knew I had to have this. Ladies and gentlemen, we have one very ugly album cover.
It's not one of the better album covers ever made of.
Well,
you know, just real quick, because I want to brag a little bit. I was lucky enough to see these guys live.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Not once, but twice on the same day. So for Spilt Milk, they toured and they played an acoustic gig around the country at Tower Records. So I saw them do an acoustic gig at Tower Records, probably, I don't know, 45 minutes or something. I mean, it was a good solid gig. Maybe not that one.
What town?
Here in Austin.
Oh, okay. Down on the drag.
And then later that night, they played at Liberty Lunch. God rest its soul.
Yeah.
But that was fun. Yep.
And it was not very crowded. Wow. Lindsay, in fact, my wife sat on the stage during the show.
Wow.
But God bless America, was it amazing. And if you ever wondered if these guys could pull it off, when you saw them do stuff acoustically and sing four-part harmony acoustically. You're like, this is the real deal. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a video of the Austin show online, and you can just see my head peeking up over, because I'm pretty close to where the band was, my head peeking up over the
I wish you hadn't have said that, because I'm sure everyone's going to drop this and go look at that now, maybe even not come back. So that's a little bit of why we're expert, ladies and gentlemen. Tony saw him twice on the same day in Austin, Texas.
Yeah. You know, I started listening to this. Tony was always singing the praises of this particular album, the band and the album. And I started listening to it about 10 years ago, and I think that's when my mind changed about them. And I went back and listened to Belly Button as well. But, you know, where I'm going with this is I think the band is making kind of a comeback, because my son, without any prodding from me, listens to this album. And I walked into his room one day, or I heard it emanating from his room one day, and I said, "Eli, you're in the Jellyfish?" And he said, "Yeah, Dad, they're great." And so I guess they're having maybe a little bit of a resurgence, or I hope they're having a little bit of a resurgence with the kids.
So. Well, I knew nothing about this band, and I started listening to them. And the first thing that hit me upside the head, well, they're extraordinarily talented. That comes out right away. Mm-hmm. And they are themselves, and they are engineered extremely well. This more noises that don't step on each other in this album than you'll find on most records.
Yeah.
But the thing that really slapped me upside the head more than anything was the influences. And this is an interesting thing. This band can sound a lot like another band, and then drop it like a hot potato and go make a different noise. They are so
adept at that.
Their quiver is filled with so many tools. And one of the fun things for me was to listen to these guys and think, who is that? On the record, I had both gentlemen and myself put out who they think they sound like. And we're going to post these pictures and see where we come. Wow. And this is not just who they sound like, because I see Burt Bacharach there.
It's funny. I see things on your thing, Doug, of bands that I should have put down that I completely missed.
Yeah, me too. I'm already thinking of like three that I can't believe I missed one.
XTC is the one that I can't believe I didn't put
down. That's a funny one for me to pick and you guys to miss.
Yeah, I can't believe I missed
The reason why I can't believe I did it is because I remember reading a Rolling Stone review of Belly Button when it came out, and the guy said, this band, one of the things that really sold me outside of just seeing the video for The King Is Half Undressed was, he said, this is a band that wants to be the American XTC. And I thought, well, there's nothing wrong with that. I ran out and bought it.
This might not surprise you, but I think they blow XTC away. So anyway, I don't want to start that fight again.
It might be I'm surprised that two of us put down Supertramp.
Why?
Everybody has Supertramp.
Oh, everybody has it. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's one song in particular that
there's two that sound like Supertramp to me. King without a castle, like a queen without a throne. I'm a dirty morning lover, and I must be moving on. Now I believe in what you say is the undisputed truth.
We all have the Beach Boys. And I think it's a particular time of the Beach Boys. The Smiley Smile and what's the other one
that
with
song?
The Honey?
Oh.
What is it? Wild Honey?
Yeah.
It reminds me of those two albums a lot, a whole bunch. In fact, I started listening to those two albums just because this kept prompting me. JM has the Zombies. Did you get the Zombies?
I have the Zombies.
Do you? I didn't put that in. I'm not sure why. Harry Nilsson, ELO.
I almost put Harry Nilsson in. Yeah, ELO. I can see that.
Tony's got ELO. I didn't put, and then James got Eno on here.
There is one part. There's one part where it sounds like it reminds me of an Eno song.
He just had to get it in, Doug.
Everybody's influenced by Eno anyway.
Does everyone have everyone has the Beatles down?
Yeah, the Beatles. You can't. I almost didn't put the Beatles because it's so Beatlesque that you don't notice it.
JM's Squeeze is right on. That's another band I didn't think about.
Did you get Crowded House?
I didn't put Crowded House.
Crowded House, I think, comes more from Belly Button than this album.
Yeah, probably so. JM didn't put Queen down, which I
can't believe. I didn't put Queen. I can't believe I didn't put Cheap Trick.
Well, Cheap Trick, I think, is, there's one song in particular on Belly Button, All I Want Is Everything, which is an obvious homage. I mean, almost a ripoff of a Cheap Trick song, and they freely admit that.
That song's a good example. These guys can jump on. These guys, if they could do a variety show where the audience tells them a song to play and they got to play some band's song and sound like that band, and they could pull off probably more bands than anybody I could think of, because they really can.
They really can emulate.
And T, you and I've got 10cc very close.
I should have put that one too.
When I first heard Belly Button, T's 10cc blew up in my brain. It's more than just sounding. These guys sing better than 10cc.
Yeah.
But they have that same partner deal going on that 10cc does that I thought was really interesting.
That was a huge point of reference to a lot of reviews of that first album.
Was it?
10cc, yeah.
Let's see. Has anybody got one that you think doesn't belong, Tony?
Eno one's a bit of a head scratcher, but
it's on JM. So
yeah. When we get there, I'll tell you.
How about Pink Floyd?
So I put Rush down because I do think there's a bit of a prog influence going on. So
when they speed up and get going, it sometimes sounds like Rush to me.
Yeah.
I put Pink Floyd, early Pink Floyd, because it sounds kind of like that.
Partridge Family?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I miss that. I don't think I know Partridge Family as well as you guys do.
I have the Archies too. Because
I love you.
These guys embrace that bubblegum pop. There's an interview with one of them where he says, you know, just because music is vacuous doesn't mean it's not entertaining as hell.
Yeah. They may be trying to make vacuous music, but they fail to make vacuous lyrics.
Yes.
I think one of the themes tonight will probably be that these guys hold their own on lyrics with anybody.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds like they're chewing bubble gum and they're dressed like Dr. Seuss, they're really doing some pretty serious stuff.
And I think one of the things I want to mention about that list that we just had of all those bands, I think one of the things that was a huge influence on these guys is when they grew up and where they grew up. So they grew up in San Francisco and they were listening to AM radio. And we've talked about what AM radio was like at the time. It was you threw a dart and hit. I mean, they'd go from one genre to the next.
They're all over.
Mix match.
Later they were big jazz fans, I believe.
Yeah. They were in the jazz club in high school, and Andy Sturmer was striving to be a jazz drummer until he realized he was never going to be good enough to do that.
That was good for him to realize that, because the guy's got pipes.
He got good pipes, and he's a good
great
drummer.
Songwriter.
He's a great drummer. He plays a stand-up kit, which is a weird thing.
It's a weird deal.
But, yeah, it's kind of like my desk. did I sneak out that I'm all in shape and everything? The similarity of 10cc is we've got these two guys. Would you agree that these two guys are kind of the whole deal and they just add on people?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us about them, Tony?
Well, they grew up in a little town called, I don't know if it's little or not, but it's a suburb of San Francisco called Pleasanton. And Roger Manning describes it as a typical Spielberg suburb. So anybody who's seen E.T. or everybody's seen E.T. knows exactly what he's talking about. It's that kind of a typical sort of Spielberg.
Yeah, anyway, drive out and you're out in a forest somewhere.
Right. They went to Ardmore High School. That's where they met. Manning was already a heck of a piano player. He was leaning towards classical stuff at an early age. But when he got into high school, as you mentioned, Doug, he got into jazz. Andy Sturmer was a year older than Roger Manning. His father was a jazz musician and got him into that music pretty young. And so that's why he was striving to be a jazz drummer. And he was a member of the jazz band, which at school, which is something Manning wanted to do. And then, as I mentioned, they were just, they listened to AM radio, but they were also just music nerds, and they would gather together and play each other records. Like, they would go to down to the record store, buy a stack of albums, and just go through them, you know, and learn from that. So, you know, they were listening to Badfinger, Henry Mancini, Nick Drake, Randy Newman, Tom Waits, the Carpenters, all of that stuff, and they just absorbed it all. So when you were talking about the, all the influences, I just want to reiterate something we said a minute ago, kind of off mic, which is they're not using these influences to sound, to be sound alike. So they're using these influences to build off of them
right.
and do something else with it. So,
like everybody does.
Absolutely.
But I think what makes these guys stand apart, let's use Tom Petty for an example. Oh, I hear the Birds. Oh, there's some Dylan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, maybe there's some Dale Shannon. Oh, cool. And, but these guys, you'll come up with 10 bands inside one song.
It's like taking your little, what is that thing you have down there framed? That history of rock and roll thing? And just throwing a dart at it.
Yeah.
You know, two or three darts. And you
know. But it blends perfectly. And the best example is the Queen thing at the beginning of this album.
Yeah.
When you listen to this album, you won't believe the Queen deal at the beginning. And that's the first thing I heard. And I thought, well, they're really good at that. And I thought it was going to be a huge part of the whole deal was going to be a Queen sound alike. And they can depart from that so completely you forget that ever happened.
Yeah.
Even, in the same song. I mean, maybe not that song.
No, they can do it in the same song.
Andy Sturmer graduates a semester early. Spend his time practicing his drummings because he's looking for a band to join. And Roger Manning, when he graduates, ends up moving to L.A. to study musical composition at USC. And it's while he's in L.A. that he meets this guy named Jason Faulkner, who is a guitarist, ends up playing guitar on the Belly Button album. But at the time when they meet, he's playing in a band called the 3 O'Clock. But they just kind of bond over music or whatever and the kind of stuff they're listening to. Manning's looking to start a band, and he's looking in the local music rag, and he's looking specifically for anybody who mentions XTC. And, of course, Jason Faulkner did, so they kind of hook up, but nothing really comes from that. And it's funny because it's around this time that Roger Manning starts working on the song Bye Bye Bye, which ends up being on Spilt Milk several years later.
Yeah.
But also post high school, while Manning's still in touch with Andy Sturmer, and Sturmer is who's decided I can't be the best jazz drummer in the world, so I got to do something else. He starts messing around on guitar a little bit, learning to play the guitar, learning to write songs, and he ends up playing in a band with this guy named Chris Kettner, and the band was called Zulu Pool, and they were like a, for lack of a better term, like a jazz pop group. And it also included this guy named George Cole on guitar and this person named Say Padilla on keyboards. Shortly after he joined, because the band wasn't making much noise on the local circuit, Kettner has this weird epiphany and decides that he's going to shake things up and the band is going to play acoustically. Like, they're not doing electric instruments anymore. They're stand-up bass. They're going to do all that stuff. So Sturmer's initially their drummer. He ends up starting to share lead vocals with Kettner, and he switches to a stand-up kit because he saw another local band doing that, and he thought, oh, that looked cool. Huh. And so he ends up standing up at the front of the stage with Kettner while they're performing, singing and playing the stand-up kit. And they start working as a songwriting team. And they end up changing their name at that time to Beatnik Beach, and it's spelled B-E-A-T-N-I-K. Beach is spelled B-E-A-T-C-H. And it's pronounced beach, not biatch.
For those of they you were ahead of their time.
That's right. Their first album, At the Zulu Pool, is released in the fall of 86 on their manager's independent label, Industrial Records. It doesn't do anything. And so the keyboardist leaves, and they end up working as a trio a little bit. Sturmer's not really thrilled with the way things are going as a trio, so he decides, hey, I know this guy down in L.A. We work good together. I'm going to get him up here. So he reaches out to Roger Manning and says, hey, can you come? Are you interested in joining the band? And so he did, and he ends up driving the 12 hours up between LA and San Francisco on a regular basis to play with the band and gig. He's feeling pressure to join full time, and his parents say, "We want you to finish college." So Manning ends up finishing college, getting a degree at USC, before he ends up joining Beatnik Beach on a permanent basis. So as this four piece, they start getting a little bit of interest from record labels. Their manager, in a moment of kind of genius, when one of the Atlantic AR guys, a guy named John Carter, who was interested in another band he was managing, the Beatnik Beach manager slips on the other side of the cassette some Beatnik Beach demos. And John Carter is interested in that. Do you guys know anything about John Carter?
I know nothing about John
Carter. Well, wasn't he in Terminator?
He co-wrote Incense and Peppermints.
Good sense, ill sense, crippling mankind. Dead kings, many things I can define. Old Cajun's blood, swaggins, blood to your mind. Incense and peppermints, the color of time.
And he worked with Bob Seger and Steve Miller Band when they were in their like commercial peak. He was the A&R guy for those guys.
Well, so. those guys knew how to put some stuff on the radio, Tony.
Yeah, he signed Sammy Hagar and Bob Welch to Capitol, and he co-wrote and produced some of their guys' early stuff, and he relaunched Tina Turner's career in the 80s.
Oh, that was a big relaunch.
That was a good one, yeah. So this guy is like a big deal, and he's interested in Beatnik Beach. And so they end up releasing their self-titled debut in 1988. It's their only release. It had six of the strongest songs from At the Zulu Pool, and they added four newer ones that had Roger Manning on keyboards. This album also flops. So anyway, Sturmer and Manning start writing together, and they show up to writing sessions with with Kettner, and these songs are almost fully realized, and he's like, uh-oh. Something's going on here. So that kind of hastens the breakup of the band, and he ends up leaving. They end up essentially, there's interest in the label, but he's Kettner's not interested anymore, so he splits. So Manning and Sturmer end up finding themselves with a record deal, but no band, and only some of the songs they've written. They're still ostensibly Beatnik Beach, but they're really excited about the stuff they're working on, and so they reach out to Carter and they play him the stuff they're doing. He's slightly annoyed because they insisted on meeting him in person. He's like, "Can't you just mail me the stuff or drop it off?" Like, no, I want you to do it. Of the songs they played for him, one of them was Bed Spring Kiss off of Belly Button, and the other one was The Man I Used to Be. And Carter's like, "Holy cow!" And his interest is piqued. So he says, "You got anything more like this?" And of course they say, "Oh yeah, sure. They didn't. And they end up going off to rewrite and stuff. A little funny side note is that because they were called Beatnik Beach, Carter said, "Well, if you guys are going to go in and record, I want you to do Season of the Witch, the Donovan song, because it's got a line in it called Beatnik's Out to Make It Rich." Uh-huh. And so in order to placate him, they end up recording that song. Neither one of them wanted to, but they're looking.
That's a cool song.
I bet they did a pretty good job with it.
Yeah. So they're like I said, they're working on these demos. That's when Manning decide they're both like, we know what we're doing around some of this stuff, but neither one of us are very good on guitar. We need to get a guitarist in here who can help us flesh the sound out. So that's when Manning reaches back out to Jason Faulkner, who is at that time playing, I jumped the gun a little bit, with 3 o'clock around LA, and says, "Hey, we'd really like you to come up and help." He also warns him. He's like, "Listen, Andy's a bit of a prickly pear. So just be warned that he's not the easiest guy to get along with." And because they had this major label deal, he agreed to come up and work on some stuff. And so that's it. Kind of moving away from the Beatnik Beach stuff, I did want to play you just the evolution. So it's a song called Worthless Heart. Here's the Beatnik Beach version. Here's a Jellyfish version of the same song, recorded several years later.
She wonders how many times this hopeless
this cycle will turn before a brighter day. Bring back the sunshine, the wine and the roses, for her it has taken so long.
You can see immediately that there's a distinct difference
between... more complicated
between,
stuff in the background.
Yeah. Lots of layered harmonies, although we didn't really hear that much in that particular clip.
But his voice, he's figured out he's a good singer by now.
Yeah. So, anyway, so they start working on demos for Belly Button. And to be fair, if you've listened to the demos, they're not your typical demos. They're really well thought out and intricate, and almost any other band would be happy with the way they sounded, but these guys weren't. In fact, when they started looking for producers, most of the people on the label was like, let's just get somebody in to like clean these up a little bit. But they actually wanted to get somebody in who would help them make the songs better.
You know, that's another thing that reminded me of 10cc is these guys' love affair with the studio and all the production ideas that they had. I guess in their later lives, they both became kind of studio rats themselves, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw them one time with Cheap Trick, didn't we? We were playing.
Well, just Roger Manning and I think Jason Faulkner, both of them played with Cheap Trick for a while. When the band broke up, Sturmer and Manning, I don't believe, have talked since
then.
Yeah,
I don't think they, yeah.
But Manning's gotten along with everybody else that was ever in the band.
And Manning is so nice.
Yeah.
And it's obviously so not his fault.
Yeah, I think everybody would agree with that.
Yeah.
To go back to the producer thing, though, I think it's funny because when Carter asked them, so we can't find a producer, nobody's really biting, do you guys have any ideas? The first person they mentioned.
John Rundgren?
No. Any guesses? Another very heavy-handed producer, Jeff Lynne.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then the second, when Carter looked at him, went, "Are you nuts?" The second person they mentioned was Roy Thomas Baker, and again he said, "Are you nuts? what kind of money do you think we're going to spend on this?" So he sent the demos around, but again, most people were like, "This just needs to be tweaked." Nobody was interested. But he told them, Carter said, "You need to check out this guy named Albie Gallatin." And they're like, "Who? Like, have you ever heard the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever?" They're like, "Yeah." He's like, That's him. And there's a bit of a connection with Albie Gallatin, if I may bring it up.
Oh yeah, baby. This groovy, we're going to go back to the 60s for just a little bit. We'll go back to the year these guys were born with that. I did realize that for the first time, I'm aware of the fact that I'm the same age as the guys we're talking about. So that was interesting, especially when evaluating the content of the lyrics.
Yeah.
So this would be me in my late 20s commenting on the world. And I just was the whole time I'm thinking, how far off are these guys from what I would have been saying?
That's so funny.
With my know-it-all self back then.
That's so funny. Any idea who Albie Gallatin played, or what album Albie Gallatin played piano on? Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs.
Did he really?
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. Did he play that beautiful outro?
No.
Jim Gordon.
He also this is kind of a tenuous connection, but he also played on Being Free, Jerry Jeff Walker's album. Played
really?
On that
really?
Too, yeah. Huh. Yep. Strange.
Yeah.
To go from that to producing the quintessential disco album. I believe he also produced at least the single for Grease, which is
wow.
Yeah.
So this guy was like on top of his game in the late 70s and then dropped off.
Yeah.
And so he was looking for something to do to get him back into the business. And when they talked to him, everything clicked. This guy had ideas. And he also had this engineer named Joseph Puig, who he said, "I got to bring this guy on. This guy will know exactly what you guys want to do. He'll be able to get you the sound you want." And so the two of them working as a team with Manning and Sturmer start working on the Belly Button album. Hmm. And It was budgeted at $76,000. And the only way they got, which is, I guess isn't a whole lot of money. I don't know. Is that a lot of money for
me? That sounds cheap to me.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap.
So one
the guy
of the,
I worked with was $200,000. And they didn't have any of the tricks these guys are doing.
One of the things that he did to convince Jack Joseph Puig to be the engineer was he said he would give him producer credit and he would give him a percentage of the sales. Huh. So I don't know if that worked out for him because I'm not sure Belly Button was huge, but
it'd be nice to have your name on something like that.
I think the combined there were 300,000 copies sold them, both of them combined.
Okay. Yep. And then Jack Joseph Puig was sort of associated with more like adult contemporary soft rock, Amy Grant, Kenny Loggins, Olivia Newton-John, Bette Midler. So it's an interesting pair of guys to be coming in. So you've got a disco guy, a soft rock guy, and these other guys with this just amazing sort of cacophony of different influences in their head, but really trying to distill it through a pop sensibility, all working together to come up with whatever you want to call Belly Button. I classify it as power pop, but
Well, it's at least that, but I don't think this band can stay inside the banks too well.
No, definitely not.
They're just too...
They are art.
Everything.
I mean, there is definitely some art rock going on in this as well. And it's it's very intricate. Their songs are so very intricate.
Well, some of it almost could be heavy metal sometimes.
Yeah,
absolutely. They didn't have a name at this time. They were still Beatnik Beach, but they didn't feel that was really what they should be. So they were trying to figure out a name. And this one guy who worked for Carter kept coming up. He was infatuated with coming up with a name for the band. And because of what he thought their sound was and the look they were going for, these are some of the names he came up with. Lust Musket, Major Nelson, Peanut Butter Porch Club, Banana Groove Pie, The Cheese Puff Gang, and even Belly Button. That was another name for a band he sent. One day, he's walking out of the studio, and he goes, "Hey, guys, I was just out." He was, like I said, he was obsessed with finding information. "I was just down at the aquarium the other day. How about jellyfish?" And they're like, no. But it stuck in the back of Andy Sturmer's head. So, when they actually – and they didn't have a name till right before – I think the album was being pressed. And somebody said, "What are we calling this?" And he's like, "Guys, how about jellyfish? It's not that bad, is it?" And they're like, "Yeah, okay." So,
I say it's a good name. I didn't like it at first.
I don't like it when you're researching them.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah.
Because you do it's get tough. Quite a bit of information. And then when I see jellyfish, I want to watch videos of jellyfish. So I got distracted easily.
So they end up, Atlantic is not interested in actually releasing it, or what are you going to distributing it, right? So they end up signing with Charisma Records, which was a subsidiary of Virgin. And at the time, Charisma, if you remember, Charisma was an old label. I think Genesis was on that, maybe. Yeah. They were like a prog rock folk label. And they were bought by Virgin in 83, and then they folded three years later, and they revived the label in 90. And Belly Button was one of the first albums they released on the revived Charisma label. Okay. So. Anyway,
so when Belly Button came out, they were pretty much riding the crest of the wave of what was coming out and what was really hip with the kids. Is that true, Tony?
Yeah, hair metal. Yeah, if there's anything to talk about with this band, if there's any sort of horrible story to tell, is their timing is horrible.
Yeah,
Belly Button is released at the peak of, or maybe it's slightly off peak, but hair metal is the thing that's happening at the time, and I guess hip hop.
I listened to Cardi B. What are some examples of hair metal?
I guess we'd have to say Motley Crue would be an example of
Poison.
Poison would definitely be Enough's Enough. I think got
put in. These are guys with big. Like Brazilian blowouts, yes. And makeup, yeah. And they kind of scream sing.
It's what I would call the equivalent of pop country. It's like pop metal. It's not really doesn't really have any of the.
But they dress better.
Yeah.
And it's there's always an androgynous kind of look to them.
And the women love them.
And their hair is either blonde or black.
Yeah. No, in between. And they rock you like a hurricane?
No, that's not a hair metal band.
Who's that?
That's Scorpions. They're not metal.
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, it's Cinderella.
Cinderella was a hair metal band.
I don't think you. I don't know if they would count.
I'm just naming bands I hate.
Usually they don't have keyboardists. That's another thing. They'll have keyboards, but they won't be official.
Lots of leopard print.
I'm sorry.
Lots of leopard print.
Well, animals in general. I don't think they limit it to just leopards.
Tiger's pants too. Yeah. I mean, Kiss could almost be labeled as a hair as a hair metal band.
They're a little early for that.
Yeah.
But maybe at the time they would have been.
I say in the early.
You guys can't tell me one song.
Smoking in the boys' room.
Ain't nothing but a good time.
Warrant.
She's my cherry pie.
Yeah, Warrant is.
Okay, those are bad.
Yeah, they're horrible. Warrant's perfect. Always some sort of double entendre, and just horrible.
But the chicks dig them.
Oh man, did they ever!
Somebody let us know what it is about guys dressed like girls singing horrible music that's sexy. So they go in the studio.
Yeah, and just like this album we're going to talk about tonight, they flesh out their sound with session guys. So they get Steve McDonald, who was the bassist for this power pop band out of L.A. called Red Cross, who, oddly enough, dressed like Jellyfish dressed before Jellyfish did. In fact, Steve McDonald often accused them of stealing their look. I don't know why you'd be worried about that, but whatever. he plays bass on All I Want Is Everything, Now She Knows She's Wrong, and Baby's Coming Back. Manning got him to join those sessions by saying, hey, we got this band going, we're trying to make a sound that's somewhere between a meld between Queen and the Partridge Family. And Steve McDonald's like, when he heard it, he's like, yeah, they're pretty right on when they say that. So he was excited about it. A jazz fusion bassist by the name of John Patitucci plays bass on this. He also plays bass on Belly Button. He also plays bass on the album we're talking about tonight. A harmonica player, Tommy Morgan. Tonight's Show trumpeter, Chuck Finley, plays on the album.
That's right.
And percussionist Lenny Castro and Louis Conte plays on Belly Button. And then they have a string section, too. So, just like we're going to talk about at the end of this album, the tension of trying to get everything perfect for Belly Button, cracks start forming in the band. And it's really difficult to not be Roger Manning and Andy Sturmer if you're in this band.
Yeah.
And so Jason Faulkner is really having trouble in the studio. He and Andy aren't getting along very well. And in fact, the story goes that the guitar solo for She Still Loves Him was done during some heated argument between Faulkner and Sturmer, with Jason Faulkner slamming his guitar down on the last note and storming off, like the bam, and just storms off. So that happened evidently a lot.
There's some sound effects on that album, or like studio sounds. And like there's one
kind of like our podcast.
Yeah. There's like you can hear the drum sticks fall rolling around on the snare drum and then falling on the floor.
I was always wondering if Manning's not the one that made anything possible on these records, like the control rod inside of a nuclear power plant, where he would just come in and calm everything down and make it possible for the band to continue.
Well, I think part of the problem actually was that he wouldn't speak up enough because he didn't want to ruffle any feathers. Okay. And he freely admits that. Like, he just sat by and let things kind of fester in a way that wasn't very healthy.
JM.
So just briefly want to talk about the album cover for Belly Button. Same guy who designed Spilt Milk would design that. His name's Mick Haggerty. He did Let's Dance. He did Beauty and the Beat by the Go-Go's and Breakfast in America.
Oh,
one
really?
Of the most iconic album covers.
Yeah, that is a
fantastic album cover.
By of what band? Supertramp.
Supertramp. Yeah, we should do that album.
So
that's like a greatest hits album. I know.
So Belly Button comes out. It's released in July of 90, as we've talked about, at the height of hair metal. Some critics got it. Other ones said it was derivative. The D word's going to be thrown around a lot on this out on Belly Button, but it doesn't get thrown around a lot for Spilt Milk.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what changed, but You know, as you said, JM, they've got this cartoon retro appearance. Because of that, they start getting heavy rotation on MTV. Mm-hmm. But the album's still a commercial disappointment. It peaks at number 124 on the Billboard Top 200.
Jeez.
There's five singles on it. The King is Half Undressed. So yeah, that video is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And heavy in rotation. So yeah, they released that. That song hits number 19 on the Billboard's Modern Rock chart. That Is Why is the second single, which hits number one. Baby's Coming Back hits number 62 on the Hot 100. That's a video that has them animated by Hanna-Barbera animators, which is kind of cool. I don't know if you've ever seen that video.
Do they have the 5 o'clock shadow?
I don't recall if they do or not.
Hanna-Barbera character had a 5 o'clock shadow in their profile.
Now She Knows She's Wrong and I Want to Stay Home, both of those failed to chart in the U.S.
How did this band do in England?
Well, how do you think?
Much better. I think they sound like a British band.
I think they do sound very like a very British band, except for the.
And San Francisco is not part of England, right?
No.
They're both islands.
I think their vocal styles, I think, are very American.
Very American pop. One band I would say vocally they sound similar to, and I don't want to get any mail from people who know a lot about this type of music in this band, but I'd say the Posies. Even though the Posies are reminiscent of the Hollies early on, as they kind of break out of that, I think there's, I'm not saying they sound exactly alike, but it's definitely an American style of power pop singing, and Jellyfish, I think, definitely hits that as well. Mm-hmm. But you will never disappoint, but breeds contempt. It makes you feel inept. Anyway, so they go on tour. Faulkner played bass on a lot of the songs on that album. They need a bassist. They end up getting Roger Manning's brother, Chris, to play bass, his younger brother.
He has to work his tail off to catch up, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a story about him. I forget what song they're trying to learn to play. He's sitting in the back. He locks himself in the back of the bus on the bass, and he's trying to learn the bass parts, and he comes out there were shocks or were off on the bus or something. He comes out and he's got bruises all over his body because he's back there trying to play, figure out the bass, and the bus is just bouncing the bass. He's beating him all to hell. They go on a year long tour. They open for the Black Crowes. For those of you who want us to do the Black Crowes, there you go. We mentioned them. And
that's done. Check it off.
And they open for World Party.
Yeah.
I did want to mention two notable covers of Belly Button because one of them's a Connection. I know we kind of slid into Connections.
We kind of unconnected from Connections. I want to stay.
Any guesses?
Rod Stewart. My God.
What's he singing?
I Want to Stay Home off Belly Button.
Wow.
Yeah.
That guy's a good singer.
Well, hold on here, just for comparison. I want to stay. When I realize the weight that's firmly on my shoulders. Not really a song Rod Stewart should be singing.
No, and I couldn't even recognize it when he was singing it.
Yeah.
And then another band covered Baby's Coming Back off of that album in 2007, a British band called McFly. The reason I mentioned them is that reached number one in the UK. Oh. Their version of it did.
Well, they'll pay some bills.
Yeah.
Yeah. So wrapping things up on that album, they're in this weird situation in that they're essentially a studio band. So they haven't played live. They go out. Their first gig, they play as a warm up. It's a secret gig. It's they're not really Jellyfish. They perform as a band called Smurf, and then the very next night they go out and they play as Jellyfish for the first time. They had to fill out their set because they only had 10 songs on the album. So they actually wrote songs to play live, which is kind of a cool thing. They had three songs, a song called Hello, which is this really great rocking opener that they opened the show with, song called Mr. Late, which had this a cappella singing ending to it. And then a song called Will You Marry Me, which evidently when they would play it, all the girls would scream yes at the band, you know, while they were doing
it. Well, that's cool that they wrote songs for the road. Yeah. Most people would have just done Mustang Sally.
And they're great songs, too. I mean, they're really, really good songs. They never recorded them, and they never played them again after that tour, which I don't get.
That's too bad. It's not on your special edition thing?
The live versions are.
Oh.
Yeah, and I'll post a video of one of them on the website, so you can...
Yeah, I think I've seen them do that Hello song.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. Roger Manning sings lead on it.
Yeah.
So...
And then Adele did it later.
While they're touring, and they only bring this guy up because he's important later, is they bring their own sound guy along, a guy named Shalom. I'm going to mispronounce his name. Shalom Aberle, I believe this is how you say it.
Shalom.
And he's in the midst of moving to Atlanta with his wife, but they want him to do this. They want him to tour with them. And when he hears the album before they released it, he's like, I got to get involved in this. So he's their sound guy, tours with them. Like I said, he'll play a little bit of a part in the story later. They go on tour. Andy is a taskmaster. He's just really taking all the fun out of being a band. Like there's the other guys who aren't Roger Manning. So Chris and Jason Faulkner just talk about how unfun this is. It's not really a band.
Yeah.
They're just constantly perfection.
Well, I heard they practiced 12 weeks for 150-minute. Show that they were doing. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Probably. Things come to a head. They go on the Letterman show and they play, I forget what song. All I Want Is Everything is the song they play. Jason Faulkner ends up going out with some friends after the show to blow off some steam. He oversleeps. He doesn't get on the plane. They leave without him. When he finally ends up going back to California, he ignores their calls. They're calling him saying, hey, we need to work on the next album. He ignores their calls. Finally, when he gets in touch with them, he's like, you know, I have some songs.
Oh, yeah. And they said, well, too bad.
Yeah, they essentially said, this is not a partnership. Yeah. And he said, well, I've got better things to do. So he splits. With him gone, Chris, Roger's younger brother, is like, he was kind of the one person that
made my friend.
Yeah, so he ends up leaving because the atmosphere was just not... He's kind of burnt out. So they're back to a duo. But they are determined to make it. So I know this is long already, but before we get into the album, I want to talk about some of the things that they did in between because they're kind of cool. Mm-hmm. One of them was an album called White Knuckle Scorin', which was a Nintendo tie-in. Huh. And it was a CD that was supposed to promote literacy for kids. And the intention was that each song would focus on the Nintendo characters or Mario World or whatever. But there's only one song that does, and that's the one Jellyfish wrote, which is Ignorance is Bliss. So what's interesting
that's
about...
That's probably a lot like what they ended up doing later in life, right?
It is. And what's interesting about that album is... here's some of the other artists on it. None of them are... It ends up being a compilation album for MCA. None of the other songs have anything to do with Nintendo. Crosby, Stills, and Nash is on it. Dire Straits is on it. Huh. Flesh for Lulu is on it.
Flesh for Lulu.
Yeah, Sheena Easton's on it.
Yeah.
It was the debut of I Drove All Night, which is the Roy Orbison song that came out after he died. It was debuted on that album. Here's the other kind of interesting thing about it. It was dedicated to Bobby Brooks, who was a talent agent, who was the guy who represented a lot of the people on this album. That guy died in 1988 in the helicopter crash that killed Stevie Ray Vaughan. I mean, not 1990, in the helicopter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So another weird connection.
And then that happened.
Well, and then there's the other thing that they did was in 1992, MTV contacted them and said, hey, William Shatner is going to be doing a performance of all of the best song nominees. We need a vibes player and a bongo player. Would you guys be interested? So they backed William Shatner doing that.
Time can break your heart and have you begging, please, begging, please. Would you know my name if I saw you in heaven? Would you be the same if I saw you in heaven?
Yes, that's Tears in Heaven.
Oh, my God. Why? That happened, and we let it happen.
They also...
I would like to know what Eric Clapton had to say about it. It's not like that's a personal song or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's up there being a beatnik, like, oh, how groovy.
The other thing that's... So they're kind of hot, even though the album doesn't sell. People in the know love them. So another person that contacts them is Ringo Starr. And they're like, I'd like you to contribute some songs to my album that I'm working on, the 1992 Takes Time LP. They gave him four songs to choose from. He chose their least favorite song, which is I Don't Believe You. But they also contributed Watching the Rain, which is an old Beatnik Beach song, I Need Love, and A Long Time Ago. I got to play you the demo of Roger Manning singing this song because you just got to hear this. It's incredible.
I need love, I need your love, I need love. I need love, I need your love, I need love. Living alone.
He's essentially trying to sound like Ringo try to sell the song, and it didn't work.
I can't believe he didn't take that.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like a Ringo song.
Yeah,
it sounds like a Harrison song.
It does sound like a Harrison. It's like a Harrison song that he wrote. Ringo would say. Yeah.
They ended up the song he picked was a very Beatles-esque song, I Don't Believe You, and they end up being in one of the videos for one of the songs. I can't remember which one it was, but they starred in the video with that. And then the other person they work with was Brian Wilson.
Oh yeah.
There's a couple of different versions of the story about that. I don't know which one's true or not, but one of them involves them going to Brian Wilson's house. Another one involves him meeting at a studio. But either way, regardless, all Manning says about it is it was very surreal. And neither one of them look back on it as like a really pleasant experience. I mean, it was imagine. They met one of their idols, but at the same time, he was not in the best mental shape at the time.
It's not good to meet your idols.
No, it's not. It's not, especially Brian Wilson.
So then they go, that's what they did in between the albums. So then they go back in earnest, start working on demos. They go to Andy Sturmer's house. They start working on the demos. They realize it's just the two of them. They still need to flesh out the sound. So they get this guy named Tim Smith from Atlanta. And how they got him was Shalom Aberley, who'd done their sound for Belly Button, was living in Atlanta. And he was doing sound for the band that Tim Smith was in, called The Producers at the time. Tim Smith was a huge Jellyfish fan. When he found out that Aberley had worked for him, he's like, oh, how do they sample their vocals? Like, what do they do? He's like, no, that's all live. He's like, BS, that's live. There's no way they're doing that.
That's what I would say.
He's like, no, I promise you, the vocals are all live. He's so blown away by it. He's like, oh, my God. Finally, he says, hey, you know, you should get in touch with them. So he reaches out to him, says, hey, I hear you might need somebody. He ends up flying out to San Francisco. I think the deal was they wanted him to pay his way. And he said, look, why don't we do this? If I get the gig, we split it. They're like, okay, that sounds fair enough. So he ends up getting the gig and he plays bass and does some guitar as well while they're working on the demos. And when they get in the studio, they realize he's not cutting it. They need somebody who's going to be able to really give them the guitar sound they need. So when Faulkner left the band, they put some ads in like various music rags around, you know, I think Billboard, I shouldn't call Billboard a rag, but they put it an ad in Billboard, just something generic, like looking for a guitar player. They had all sorts of offers, including from hair metal guys that were on their way out.
looking for the next thing.
Huh? And they end up getting this guy named Lyle Workman, who's a guitarist for a band called Bourgeois Tag. And he joins the band for the recording process. Now, for those of you who don't know, mainly probably you two guys, Lyle Workman worked on a lot of movie scores. He worked on, I'm not saying they're like giant scores, but he worked on the score for Superbad, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and the two Jon Favreau films, Maid and Chef. He did a bunch of other stuff too, but those are just the ones that I recognized.
You know, I can't get those scores out of my head.
And then, of course, because they were working, they wanted to one-up Belly Button. They get the two guys who worked on Belly Button, Jack Joseph Puig and Albie Gallatin, in, and they start essentially pulling in instruments that they want to use. And this gets crazy. They spent 2 days working on the drum sound, just the drum sound.
Well, there's a good sound.
At one point when they're talking about the Andy saying, I would like this elephant stampeding bass line in All Is Forgiven, Albie Gallatin's like, oh, we'll get some special bass strings made. And Tim Smith is like, what the hell are you guys talking about? And so the excitement of working on this album started to fade because they're starting to get, he's like, he realized they're bogged down in trying to make this like so perfect that it's kind of zapping some of the fun out of it. But at the same time, when Tim Smith realizes, holy cow, I'm involved in this amazing sounding album, you know, he doesn't want to step away from it.
Yeah. And it is amazing. So there are a lot of instruments in this on this album.
And they don't step on each other.
No, they don't. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And so just finally, before we get into the album, it was originally going to be called Night of the Sound Fable.
That sounds like the album.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was basically because of this concept they'd come up with, which was based on Hush, which we'll get to when we start talking about the album. But it was this idea of this album being a collection of dreams, little dream snippets.
I could see
so, that. So that was the concept, the loose concept in which it was based on. Now, there's a whole lot of people out there in the interwebs. And one of our loyal listeners by the name of Kenny Kipp, who has been dying for us to do this album for, a decade or more. that's a joke. Yeah. He also has kind of an understanding of we've emailed back and forth about what the concept is. I used to think this album had a story to it. I was wondering if
it had a story or not.
I don't believe that anymore, mainly because of stuff, interviews I've seen with the band, reading the Brighter Day book.
And the reason why I kind of think that it does have it seems like it was supposed to, because how it starts off and how it ends. It sounds like it's like it's bookend by the same sort of.
Well, it is
begins and ends on the same
note.
Yeah.
It can play in a loop, but I think the idea of the loose concept of it being a series of dreams is really what the concept is. There may be some through storylines, or maybe some threads you can weave together, but I now have a different opinion about this album. I don't think the guys were intentionally trying to piece together something that told a story.
Yeah.
So when they came up with the name, when they changed it to Spilt Milk, they wanted to get this little girl crying about it. They had this concept of pulling back the curtain and showing the studio behind the, like, all the instruments, but they also wanted to have somebody crying over spilt milk. And so they get this little girl, and once they dress her up as a princess, which she says on the cover,
she's not sad.
She doesn't want to cry. She's like, I'm the princess. I'm not supposed to cry. Thankfully, she had a show mom who kept telling her if she doesn't do what they say, she's just going to ruin her career. And that, of course, got her crying, and they ended up getting the album cover they wanted.
She looks defiant on the album cover.
She does.
Nice little girl. It's just it's just weird. And this album comes out, and they're kind of at the cutting edge of a new sound.
Yeah, their timing is awful again. So while they were recording this album, something weird happened in Radioland. Grunge.
Yeah.
And this album is anti. This is as close to grunge as Vivaldi.
Yeah, this is the anti grunge.
It is. And it's.
I think most of those grunge players would they would find themselves tied up in a knot after two measures.
There's two people on this that we should mention that are on the album. One is John Bryan. He has done a lot of soundtrack work as well. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He plays guitar on this. He's done, who's that director he works with a lot? The guy who did Punch Drunk Love. He was famous, works with a lot of with that director in a lot of his movies. The bass player, the guy who shows up on a few songs, is T-Bone Walk. He, anybody know what he's probably most famous for? He was the bass player for Saturday Night Live for a long time. Huh. And he was worked a lot with G.E. Smith.
G.E. Smith's so great.
Yeah.
What a great guitarist that guy is.
He is a fantastic guitarist. Unfortunately, he died about, I think it was 2010 or so. Of a heart attack.
But there's somebody else on this album who's also sort of on, well, he's on a song and a half, I guess, if you will. Jay Bennett.
Are you serious? Of Wilco?
Yes. Yeah, and we'll get to that story too, but Jay Bennett also plays guitar on towards the end of the sessions. Huh.
Wow.
Yeah. But the main guitarist is Lyle Workman.
Yeah, man, yeah. He does some excellent, excellent work.
Yeah.
All right, fellas.
We're finally ready to get to the album.
We have approached this album, and the first tune is called Hush.
Keep hearing that song.
Well, that happens a lot in this show.
Yes, it's unusual. It starts off with a lullaby. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously an intentional choice.
Yeah.
And it sort of changed the focus of the album once they decided to do that.
The key changes are amazing on this. Yep.
I do want to play something real quick. So this was based on a little idea that Andy Sturmer had, and he gave it to Roger Manning thinking it would be just a little throwaway B-side. And then Manning spent hours on the song and ended up giving him this.
Go to sleep and hush, little baby. Your mommy's killed and it's raining outside.
So Andy said he
heard that too.
Andy said he heard that and went, I think his exact quote is, it made quite an impression. So
is that him by himself?
Yeah, that's him multi-tracking his vocals.
That's incredible.
And he turns it into this sort of Beach Boys meet Queen bonanza.
Very much.
And so they decided they would change it and do that sort of song cycle I talked about, where they would come up with this concept of starting the album off with a lullaby, which a couple of things, they kind of liked throwing wrenches at the audience. And there's a couple of points on this album where there's a jarring transition from one song to another.
Like at the end of this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because it goes from Hush straight into joining a fan club. That was something they really dug. The thing that's amazing about this song is it's pretty much, I mean, there's very little instrumental in it, except for there's a little bit of some strings and bells towards the end, but it opens up, it's all a cappella, and it, amazingly so.
Yeah. Rachmaninoff's Vespers. It's that intricate and that well done.
That's good.
I was 23 when this album came out, maybe 22. And I remember putting this on. Like, I bought it when the day it came out, and I put this album on and hit play and heard this, and it immediately, I thought, oh my God, what am I in for? This is not what I was expecting, even from their last album, which had lots of vocal stuff going on.
But it didn't have anything like this.
Did you think
Queen right away when you heard this?
I did. Queen and like I said, the Beach Queen Boys, and Beach Boys.
Beach Boys.
I started out hearing Queen a lot more, and eventually it moved towards the Beach Boys.
Yeah. And I want to just briefly talk about Andy Sturmer's voice. Because it's really great.
It is. Yeah.
And it has that same quality that I love in McCartney, in that it can be syrupy sweet, but then it can have a growl to it when it needs to, and it doesn't miss a beat when it does that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Do you have any idea what his range is?
I don't.
I would guess it would be even wider than mine. Well, we don't get to go to sleep.
Well,
we get our butt kicked awake by joining a fan club. We got a little bit of that edge you talked about.
Yeah.
And then we also get some of the, at the beginning of that clip, we get some of the hard Queen sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. I mean, even the drums sound like Roger Taylor drums in that, I think.
And I was just noticing when we were listening to that, something I wanted to just touch on, the bass tone on this album is really great.
It's really very interesting, too. Yeah. It's not your typical bass thud. It's very interesting. And the bass on this is, this particular song is incredible.
I had friends when this album came out that made fun of this band. They said, oh, they're a bunch of lightweights. And this is exhibit A that this guys could rock when they
wanted to. What did they mean by that?
They thought they just, the image, their image, they thought they were just a bunch of. And I like how it, even though musically it's jarring, it slides into the theme from the last song when it's, she turned the night light off and blew him a kiss.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yep. And the jarring business, all of that does not take away from the melody at all. And that's through this whole. Through this whole record, they're doing pretty aerobic playing and jumping about, and the melody doesn't get interfered with at all. It's pretty interesting the way they can pull that off.
Yeah. And I think the lyrical concept is pretty a neat concept, talking about it, you know, the fan club of being a rock star fan club.
Picking up a fallen star.
And then the mom in this song, who's obviously in a different kind of fan club, which is some televangelist that she's fallen for, who's obviously not the ethical
televangelist. He may not have a board of directors that's carefully going over his earnings and his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a theme through this. This guy likes to take a poke at religion anytime he has and I'm assuming it's Andy that's doing the poking.
Andy's the songwriter or lyric writer. And there are a lot of religious themes. I think maybe. Of all the songs, maybe two don't mention something to have to do with religion.
Yeah, it's like he got hurt by religion at some point. Yeah.
But I mean, I don't have a problem with him poking fun at these particular types of people.
No. He should have to get in line behind me.
Yeah, and just a little brief aside, when I saw them at Tower Records, I had him sign my copy of Spilt Milk, and I thought it'd be fun. There's a line in the song, the St. Pinocchio line, is shake that Woody for me, St. Pinocchio, which of course has two meanings, right? Woody has two meanings.
I don't get it.
But I thought it'd be funny to have him write that. And he looked at me. He wrote it, but he looked at me like, what the hell do you want me to write shake that Woody for? But he ended
up writing. I think I would have looked at you the same way, T. Sorry. St. Pinocchio.
And I also love that just it seems like just a toss away line, but that line about I get heartburn when I think about all the stamps I ate, you know, just the pure unadulterated.
It's such a weird thing to write a song about.
Yeah.
And the thing he does is his lyrics are so descriptive. Like, you can close your eyes and see exactly what he's talking about, which is unusual.
And they have a lot of zingers.
It's unusual for a power pop band to have lyrics like this.
I agree, because power pop bands, they don't want to walk in deep mud and get slowed down
like
with some lyrics.
By the laws.
He doesn't get slowed down one bit with his complicated lyrics and his imagery. This is where you talk about the thing you admire in someone. That is the thing that you know that you should stop doing yourself.
Yeah.
And I really like, we've talked about this before on the Tom Petty deal.
Of Spike?
Yeah. Where I just reveled in him giving that kid hell. Yeah. I really, really do like a smart aleck that can dish it out. And he does that on this album very well. Very clever.
Yeah.
He doesn't slow down to talk about how clever he was. He just keeps moving to the next thing.
Yeah. Yep.
Sabrina, Paste, and Plato.
Chesney's looking dapper in his brand new dunce cap, strolling down the runway to an F. With all the others watching, eating Paste and Plato, he fights the urge to run and kiss the chef. But she's a love, a terry, and a...
So we get a new lead singer on this song.
Yeah, I think that they probably got Roger to sing it because he's got a little bit more of a boyful sound.
I think
boyish kind of sound to his voice.
Yeah, he doesn't have that powerhouse deal that wouldn't be appropriate for the boy sound.
I love this song so much. This song to me is the distillation of everything great about this band.
I think Paste and Plato, not Plato.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, when you listen to it, you hear Paste and Plato.
Right.
That's what I heard.
But when you take a look at the lyrics, you got Paste and Plato. I'm not sure what he's going for there. But
and it's one of those things. Sometimes bands are a little too clever, where the word, written word, is not what you hear because of, you know, you're thinking Plato, and it's Plato, and you look at it, you go, oh, that's clever written, but if you don't get it from the song, it's like, it's kind of lost on that. The song is so full.
It is.
And it's so playful.
Yeah, it's a jaunty number.
It goes from, again, that hard Queen sound and rock and roll to a pause, and then here comes the little boy voice again.
and it's probably the most psychedelic song on the album. Well, it's got that carousel sounding thing. And
but you know how I put the Partridge Family on my list of bands. I mean, this sounds like a knockback. This is based on a little snippet of music that Andy had in his head. He'd also found a bit of, I guess when they were looking for songs for this album, they found a bit of a tape with Roger singing part of it. But then he also had this "So Serene Makes Me Feel So Serene" in his head. And he's like, I don't want to write a love song around this. What can I do? So I didn't know this. I mean, I always wondered what this song was about, because it's full of imagery, very, very good imagery, but it's tough to tell what it's about. It's essentially about a substitute teacher who's at her wit's end, so she slips the kid's booze.
Oh, I didn't know about the booze part. I knew that it was a sub that's losing her mind.
She slips the kid's booze, and things are falling on the floor.
There's something about, they mention alcohol in here.
They say, when going back to the religious lyrics, they go, she's the shepherdess of the muscatel, is what, you know. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I mean, but he says, it's funny because he says, in a million years, he never thought he'd write a song like that. But that, this is his quote, but that's the benefit of the gibberish approach to lyric writing.
Well, I'm glad you said that about her. I knew that she was at her wit's end, but I didn't know that she came up with a solution.
Yeah.
All right. Up next, we have what, I'm not sure this isn't my favorite song on the record, New Mistake.
Tubular Bells on there. Yeah, I think this is my favorite song. It's definitely the closest to a hit, too, I think.
This is maybe my favorite pop song of all time.
Yeah.
I think this song is perfect.
It is perfect.
I'm going to say a song it reminds me of, not sound-wise, but I feel the same way about this song as I do about Killer Queen. And what I mean by that is both songs are, there's not any empty room in them. They're so full. There's so much going on, but they don't feel crowded at all. And I don't know how either of those songs do that.
That's right. Yeah.
You know?
There's so many things going on.
Oh,
it's got
my
that,
Lord.
It's got that Supertramp Wurlitzer sound.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, and the castanets, too.
Yeah,
I mean, if this doesn't sound like the logical song, I don't know what does.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's got that it's got the hand claps, too. So, yeah.
This was the second single, and it peaked at number 55 on the UK charts. I don't think it did anything in the States.
What is wrong with people?
At this time, maybe you had to have a really cool video to get anybody's attention. I don't know. If I heard this, I got my little thing on my watch with my Shazam. Uh-huh. So if I hear this song, boom, I hit my Shazam and I go buy this.
Yeah. My friend Rich, he has done this thing a couple of times where he'll put out what he does a lot of work on it, what he thinks is the top 100 power pop songs of all time. And the first time he did it, I gave him hell for not,
because this wasn't on there.
This wasn't number one. It's like, how is this not number one? Well, he
what was his number one?
I don't remember, but he found the error of his ways and he redid them a couple years ago, and this was number one, where it rightly deserves to be. I think this is just the perfect song.
Well, and it's very, very well written lyrics.
Oh, the lyrics are great.
Yeah,
and the subject matter, I think. This is a pregnancy.
An unwanted pregnancy. Yeah.
Except now it's wanted.
It is.
And it's such an unusual subject for a song.
I love my new mistake. Yeah.
It starts off with this guy. I mean, just the lyrics, thinking about when you're thinking about the craziness of doing something stupid because you're knocked over the head with love. He's like, I knew better that perfume was gravity, pulling him closer to what could be tragedy. Love is blind, deaf and dumb, but never mind. This guy's like, I can't control myself.
That's, you know, great writing.
It's great. And then he's like, you better catch me with my fall. I'm on my roller skates, because he's so, he can't control. I mean, that's,
it is
great.
It is superb. You don't expect this level of writing in a pop song.
Yeah.
No.
It's just really exceptional.
And then this line right here, which is like, it tells you the baby's come, which I think is just fantastic. Looks like our hero's going to fall. The boughs are bound to break. I just think that's fantastic. And then, of course, it ends up wrapping up with the kid growing up and making her own new mistake by marrying a pop singer. And that is what, you know, people tie that into the concept. They're like, oh, this is the little girl from Hush. Uh-huh. And this is the pop singer is joining a fan club, and it's also the one that's at the Ghosted number one. So they tie all this stuff together. Yeah. So
the band didn't even need to do the work on it. They got the fans do all of it.
So
is this autobiographical at all?
No.
Okay. No wonder they're so happy.
Well, and how about the outro? Do you know what song inspired this outro?
No.
When after all, it's just a compromise of the things we do for love.
Little 10cc.
Listen to it, though.
Yeah, there's another one of those, the band that you can't nail down.
Yeah.
It's so different than some. Yeah.
So
they
it's
were
like, it's
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Supertramp meets 10cc meets Lord knows what else. I mean, but it's such an amazing, amazing, amazing song. I have a question for you guys. I mean, I know I'm talking about it because I love it so much, but there's not another band in the last 30 years that put out a song like this.
I think you're right. I mean, I
don't know a band that does what these guys do.
There's not one
that I've not heard anything like this before. This is almost, when you look at the musicians, there probably should be about 27 people playing on this record so that they could tap into this, tap into that.
Yeah.
And
also, like a Pet Sounds sort of, you know, that's not Hal Blaine playing drums. Yeah.
No, I guess it's their vocabulary is so huge.
Yeah.
This is an interesting story about this. When they demoed it, the guitar solo got cut off prematurely. And when they went to the studio, they're like, they explained it to Albie Gallut, and the producer was like, we need to, and he's like, no, it's perfect the way it is. Yeah. It's perfect.
He won them over finally.
Yeah. And they were like, okay, all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think everything on that song turned out perfect.
Yep. I agree.
The next song is Glutton of Sympathy.
Passing lipstick, cotton spoons, burning jealous pictures of marriages, of friends. You never asked to be the glutton of sympathy.
I love the way that song starts off and where it goes and how the harmony vocals, and it's just the instruments that just keep kind of popping in and out, and you know, like you heard that those vibes coming in.
Almost all these songs seem like suites.
Yeah,
where it's not just a simple tune; it's a construction of several tunes.
Yeah.
But what's weird about this song is, regardless of all the vocal acrobatics all over all the other songs, I think this has my favorite background vocals on it.
It's got some cool background vocals.
That bit we just heard with the oohs and the ahs, I get goosebumps every single time comes up.
The singing in the foreground's powerful.
Yeah.
And the Lyle Workman hitting those weird little guitar punctuations that seem, that should not work. They should be out of place on a song
like this. It should be, wow, that's ruined. That's too crowded. That's too crunchy. That's too distorted. It's not.
Yeah, no, it's.
I wonder how many things they tried for each.
Yeah,
for each song.
Well, and the way the song opens is actually based kind of on a true story. Andy had gotten in a fight with his girlfriend. They were living together, and he went out to the living room, and he thought the TV was on because the room had this weird blue glow to it, and it was just a crystal clear night with all the stars shining. So that's where that line comes in that opens the song up.
It's surprising to learn he got in a fight with his girlfriend. We got this other tune called The Ghost at Number One.
So he shoots up his poison until the frosting tastes so sweet.
Like a valentine.
Yeah, he's giving it all. He's got the gang of rebels at the jack.
And then it's like two songs in one.
It is. It's got that Partridge Family harpsichord in it. And this is like if you gave the Archies acid, this is what they would sound like to me.
Yeah, this was their first single on the album. Didn't do much.
I can see why they picked it because of that hook. I would have picked three others first.
New Mistake was the second one. Yeah. I do want to say, though, I think that another reason they picked it is because it's the song that's most similar to The King Is Half Undressed and Belly Button Stuff. Yeah. It's even got that same weird thing where it's going along and then there's like this bridge in the middle where everything stops.
Yeah.
And you get that, you know, Mrs. Lynn, the fruit of
labor. Yeah.
You know, the same thing with The King Is Half Undressed. It's got that middle part in it.
That to me sounds so Beach Boys.
Yeah.
Do that.
And this, of course, is about, you know, there's other songs that talk about this. I think this one does it really well, the kind of what happens when a star dies and the record industry says, oh, we want to milk these guys. What's the line of the chalk line dollar sign? And what a great
another
image,
great
right?
line.
You know, just milk these guys for all they're worth. But then again, it also there's a bit of a commentary on the fact that fans don't mind. They're more than willing to give up their money for all this product too. Mm-hmm. So
like the guy that bought that special CD pack for the Jellyfish.
They're not dead. Paul Tanner, do you know who that is?
No.
He plays the theremin on this song.
Oh, is that right?
He's the same guy that played the theremin on Good Vibrations.
Is that right?
Yes, that was the one thing that came, one of the positive things that came out of their meeting with
Brian Wilson.
The other thing this song has is, and you know, I have these little sort of sounds in my head of what bands I know sound like. It's got that bombastic Beach Boys boom, that drum that is, like some monster
kettle
drum.
Kettle drum, yeah.
Well, we got a song number 7. We just flipped over the album.
This is a CD.
CD. We don't get to flip things over anymore. Bye, bye, bye.
We got a polka, guys.
Great song.
It is a great song.
It's so smart for people to do something different, like a polka or anything. It's just such a relief.
This is one of the oldest songs that's on this album. It was originally demoed for Belly Button, and I think I mentioned earlier it was written when Roger started writing it when he was in college. What's funny is there's an interview I heard of them talking about, I think it was around Belly Button, talking about how they want to get to the point where they could just do anything, like put a polka on an album.
Yeah.
And here they are.
Yeah. Well, and but it's weird because it starts off really sounding like a cabaret song, and then it sounds like a march, you know, a polka march going down the street in a parade or something. And then it reminds me of Supertramp.
No, I think, well, yeah, I get that.
Take a look at my girlfriend.
And the lyrics are fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, it's essentially about this. I love that. What is it? Gray hairs they deserve.
They deserve. Yeah.
And you know, this couple, this woman, it sounds like this woman essentially talked her husband into retiring, but they're still not happy. And that line about solitaire is not just a game. Like she's very lonely still, even though they're not. And then come to take you home.
Yeah.
I think
bye-bye.
religious significance to that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does not interrupt the flow of the record at all, but it provides a real nice relief and I don't mean to say relief because I'm not tired of anything. It provides a change.
Yeah.
Anyway, all is forgiven.
Is it?
Is this an angry song?
Yeah.
He doesn't have a very good voice for anger. He has more of a snarky voice, but you can tell he's angry.
Yeah.
And the musicians are helping.
Yeah.
Well, what's weird about this song is the music isn't isn't playing much of a tune. It's just a wall of sound. The tune comes from the vocals.
Yeah, but you can cacophony.
Yeah.
The instruments are upset.
Oh yeah, no. And the lyrics are something else. Oh, yeah. You know, a guy goes from souring the milk of human kindness to biting the nipple off. I mean, it's something else.
This is as subtle as Masters of War.
Yeah.
Well, and
there's that part in the middle where it just breaks down. They just have all those little chimes. Every time I listen to this when I was running or mowing the lawn or something, I always thought that I was getting a call on my phone.
That's hilarious. That's just to remind you that we're in a dream world.
Yeah.
You know, another exhibit A of this band being able to bring it when it comes to being loud and rocky.
Yeah.
This is one of the songs where you say he doesn't really have a voice to be angry, but it is one of his more growly performances. Mm-hmm. The demo is even better. The demo, his vocals are great in it. Hmm. And I almost like his vocal performance on that better than I do. The song is better on the album, mm-hmm. but his vocal performance is better on this.
All is forgiven.
The two things I want to say before we move on. One is I think this has the most Queen-like harmonies of any song on the album. That weird kind of...
When they take a little stop and...
Yeah. And then the part where it goes, hypocrite, full flesher, snake in the grass. The story goes there that Andy Sturmer was looking for a synonym for liar. So he looked up in the thesaurus and just wrote down the words he saw. It's like, the song wrote itself at that point. Wow.
Any idea what got him so upset?
No. I mean...
lost his parking place.
I mean, it's obviously, this is a guy who's cheating on his wife, right? But he's constantly trying to go back to her, and she's, I guess, letting him. I don't know if there's even some sort of weird sort of abusive thing going on here. I don't know where that comes from, where the song came from.
Well, we're practically saints, so these are hard for us. Well, up next is we take a little trip to San Francisco, and it's Russian Hill.
We trade the comics, cartoons, and magazines for pistons and gasoline. We see the road from the bedside, parked under the sunshine.
It's like whiplash transitions from All Is Forgiven to this.
This is probably my second favorite song on the album. I don't know. It's so interesting, and it's got that it's hard to pick a part to play because there's so many different interesting parts going on. I mean, on the song, never really, you know, it's not as whiplashy as some of the other songs, but there's that, the strings that come in, and then it's got that, like, it's almost like a Henry Mancini score, like 60 score for one of those, you know, funny spy movies, you know.
When they did this song, the producer, Abby Gluten, said, you know, I just don't get this. He goes, every time I hear it, my mind wanders. And Andy's like, bingo. He's like, that's exactly what
this is. He's just kind of wandering around in the morning.
It's supposed to be that way. Yeah.
So I heard that it was him lamenting the fact that he had to leave this beautiful place because he couldn't afford it.
Well, what the deal was is he had an apartment in Russian Hill, and it's evidently this gorgeous part of San Francisco, but he wasn't ever there. So he had to do this sort of cost benefit analysis, like, okay, I'm paying this rent, but I'm not there. I'm on the road. Is it worth it? So he gave it up. And he's, you know, he's lamenting the fact that that not everybody can enjoy this because it's so expensive. You know,
I know that this is when it became really important that I was the same age as he was, because I can remember that discovering at some point, oh, you can't just have a Guadalupe riverfront property with 100 acres. That idea that everybody ought to be able to have a house on Russian Hill. Everybody ought to be able to have this.
Yeah.
And then I think there's that period of time in your 20s when you start realizing all the stuff that you can't have. Yeah. And I think it makes a lot of people start hating capitalism rather than the reality of scarcity. And that this song reminded me of that.
But it does something, I think, fairly well in its balance of its cynicism about that. I mean, it talks
about... Well, he doesn't take the deep dive like I talked about so many other people do, where they get angry as though somebody is supposed to be sorting all this out where everybody gets a nice thing.
Yeah.
Rather than coming to the adult realization that some people get nice things and some people get less. Anybody's been to San Francisco and seen all this, all you can think about is, this is the prettiest city in the United States. Everybody ought to be able to live here.
Yeah.
Of course you can now. You just get a box instead of a house.
So musically, two things I want to talk about. One is the jazz bassist that played on Belly Button, John Patitucci, plays on this song, upright bass on this song. Bruce Kaplan is a steel player on this track.
Yeah, I was wondering if that's a steel or if he was just doing a guitar solo.
This is why it's difficult to tell, because they kept trying to get him to play. They're like, okay, let's do it again. And he'd get close, but not quite where they wanted to. And so at one point they're listening to the playback and they somehow, for some reason, hit all, like they had three steel tracks. They hit all three of them at the same time. And they're like, bingo, this is it. And so that's what it is. That's what you hear on the album. Really cool. So it's just this lucky mistake.
Yeah. There's a lot of mistakes.
And it's definitely haunting.
Yeah.
But of course, Manning's falsetto voice over it adds to that as well. This kind of dreamlike quality to the song.
And is there a Mellotron on this? I could have sworn. I don't know if it's
probably
like a fake Mellotron.
It sounds like one of the most Mellotronian songs of all time.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
All right. Up next we have He's My Best Friend.
Knowledge means when I would rather he close his eyes, push me aside. My hands are five-leaf clover. It's on Sunday over and over. I never had the look of swingers. So I was wrapped around your finger.
This reminds me of Queen again. You know why?
Best
friend? This is my second favorite straightforward song about a best friend.
This is the one that I thought sounded like Brian Eno. It's because there's not the song itself, but some of the sounds that come out remind me of there's a string sound that's in it.
Well, he probably has. I bet Eno has connections with this.
Andy Sermer said it's the one song of theirs that he, if anybody could dance to, it'd be this one.
I love the drums on it too.
Oh, it's the best drums on the album. Yeah. I think these are by far the best drums on the album.
Just so tight.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. Are we just going to dance around the obvious here?
It's a song about
friendship.
Friendship with yourself.
Yeah. No, this is a song about
another one of those classics.
It's maybe they should just call it Double Entendre instead of He's My Best Friend. It's about self-admiration, let's put it that way.
Or what's his, Angela's Ashes, what's his name? You say interfering with myself.
So this almost didn't make it on the album.
Wow.
And they left it on because they felt like the album needed a little bit of levity to it. And this song definitely provides that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that don't like this song. They think it's a throwaway song. I don't get that at all. This song is great.
I mean, I like the call and response that happens on one of the verses. I mean, that's one of the things that does not keep the verses the same. I mean, he'll never sing the verse the same way twice.
My favorite thing Andy Sturmer says about this song is he says, it's another love letter to Harry Nilsson, which I think is absolutely perfect.
It does remind me of his song.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's got that playfulness to it. And you could hear Harry Nilsson. I said this to you, Doug, when we talked about this, about a couple of days ago, that there's an XTC song off of Oranges and Lemons called Pink Thing. Andy Partridge says that song is not necessarily about what it sounds like. He says, it's whatever you hear first, that's what it's about. But the title comes from the fact that his wife called their first kid Pink Thing. So it's either about a baby or it's about some other sort of pink.
I think it's about the ice cream you get at Six Flags.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Anyway.
Get one of those. We're going to lose our G rating.
Yeah.
Too much, too little, too late.
That's such a great line.
Yeah. Tune itself is almost cliche, but it's just, the instruments, the way that they're coming in, and just they almost do like a counter. The guitars do a counter melody almost at one point, and there's just cascading going on throughout it. It's one of my favorite songs on the album.
So this was the first song that they did. There wasn't a demo for. This was done, and they left this song and the next song off to create in the studio. And when it came to the song, Alvy Gluten came to the guys, Roger Manning and Andy Sturmer, and said, you know what? Lyle Workman's been doing great on this album, but this song needs a bit of energy. And so they didn't think Lyle was cutting it. So they ended up looking for another guitarist to play on it. So one of the first people they got was John Auer of the Posies, because they were recording Frosting on the Beater down the road or down the studio a bit. And he listened to the track and said, I'm not the right person for this. I can't do it. So then they got John Bryan to do it. And he nailed it and played, you know, was all over it. And they liked it. But also Jay Bennett is on it too. This is a song Jay Bennett is on. Jay Bennett's also on the next song, but Jay Bennett plays guitar on the verses on this song. And John Bryan is playing the other guitar parts on it. Oh, the thing I forgot to mention about John Bryan was one of the main reasons he didn't end up joining the band was he had already agreed to be in another band called The Grays with Jason Faulkner.
Well,
a big circle.
We come to number 12, Brighter Day. I step in like a brigade down the block. Don't be shy to hear somebody say, it's time to join. That's the longest song on the album.
Well, there's a story behind that. They had every session person that came in play a bit. They built this song completely from scratch. They built the sound of it first before any of the lyrics, which is not how they normally wrote. So they didn't have a tune or anything. They just had this idea that two things. They wanted the last song to have every instrument that was on the album, every song previously.
Oh, really?
And they wanted every session guy to come in to lay down something to put on the song. So, and then they built the song from all that stuff. And then they said, here's the music. Have at it, Andy. And he's listening to it and he's like, it sounds like a circus.
It does.
And that's where the idea came from.
There's something circus-onian about the entire record.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many songs in 1993 released started with a banjo, especially a pop song?
Especially, yeah.
Then this is the song that ends the way the album starts.
Yeah. Here's a bit of trivia: the very last guitar chord on this song, therefore on this album, is played by Jay Bennett.
And almost every verse is different on this.
Yeah, I mean that's what he had to do. He had to kind of come up with a. With something to fit the music. It's got some of my favorite lyrics in it. We mentioned one at the very beginning, the 1 foot in a grave and 1 foot on a banana peel. I use that all the time when I'm talking about my own old age.
Yeah.
Like, I've got 1 foot on the grave and 1 foot on the banana peel.
And you almost think the song's ending and then it comes back. I thought they had gone into another song.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then as Doug mentioned, it wraps up with that little instrumental bit and then fades into the very same note the album starts with.
Yeah.
So it's a loop.
So one never needs to stop listening.
Why would you?
T?
Yeah.
Why is such a talented band, why have they left us with just two albums?
They things started cracking a little bit when they were recording this album. Towards the end of the sessions, they're working 12 to 14 hour days. On a good night, they're getting 4 hours of sleep. They decide they're going to work on a big intro that will fade into Hush. And they called it the Overture of the Sound Fable. So they're working on it. For some reason, Andy can't get his head wrapped around it. So he steps out for about 20 or 30 minutes. And when he comes back, Roger and Andy Galuten had come up with something. And they play it for him. And he doesn't like it. He's like, this is too big. This is too much. This is going to sound weird coming into, you know, running into Hush. And Roger Manning gets pissed off about that. And it's the first time he really bristles at something. And he says, he's like, you weren't in here working on this. How can you come in and all of a sudden start bad-mouthing something that we worked on? Well, Sturmer doesn't like that. And he goes, you finish the album on your own. And he storms out of the studio. Roger's like, oh, crap, I overreacted. He runs after him. They have a talk. He's like, I just need a break. He leaves. He ends up coming back to the studio to finish up the album. But things were never the same after that. So then when they go out on the road and they get a guitarist named Eric Dover to go play with them on the road, because Lyle Workman's gone, things are very, very tight around them. And really Andy and Roger only talk when they're talking about band stuff. Mm-hmm. They get along fine. I mean, it's not like the Ramones where Joey and Johnny aren't talking to each other, but they're really only talking business and they're kind of going their own ways in terms of that stuff. When they did get together to start writing, it was obvious that they had different ideas. Sturmer started listening to singer-songwriter stuff. He started listening to James Taylor. He started listening to Van Morrison. Mm. He started writing songs that Roger Manning didn't really have any interest in doing. In fact, Roger Manning says he went over and Andy played him this beautiful country, like classic country ballad. And he left with almost having tears in his eyes because while it was beautiful, he had zero interest in recording it. The last thing they ever recorded was Think About Your Troubles, the Harry Nilsson song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was for a tribute album that called For the Love of Harry, Everybody Sings Nilsson. And it was the brainchild of Al Kooper. And the reason Al Kooper wanted to do it was because he went to visit Harry Nilsson after he'd had his heart attack and saw that he was in financial dire straits. He's like, I want to do something to help this guy. So he thinks up this idea of getting some younger artists or whatever, some other artists to do songs. And he goes to Harry Nilsson. He's like, what do you think about this? And Nielsen's like, man, that's great, but you got to get one of my favorite bands, Jellyfish, to be
really
on. Yeah. And the reason he knew about Jellyfish was because at some point on their tour, Frank Stallone had gone to see them. And Frank Stallone goes after the show, goes up to him and says, man, my neighbor would love you guys. I'm going to bring you to see him when you're in LA. And he's like, who's your neighbor? He's like, Harry Nilsson. So Harry Nilsson goes to see him play and he's blown away by him. They talk afterwards and they're like, we need to get together and write stuff. And they're like, holy cow, this is like a dream come true. 6 weeks later, he's dead.
Wow.
Yeah. So the last thing they record is this.
He left his body to the bottom of the ocean. Now everybody knows that when a body decomposes, the basic elements are given back.
And they never officially did anything again, and they came to an end on April 4th, 1994. Now, I do want to say, just because I find this interesting, on that album, Randy Newman was on it, Joe Ely's on it, Ringo Starr's on it, Steve Fobert's on it. Marshall Crenshaw's on it. It's like a who's who we've done podcasts for. Sturmer's the one who doesn't really get along with anybody. Jason Faulkner, I mentioned, formed the Graves with John Bryan. Manning formed a band called Imperial Drag with Eric Dover after Jellyfish broke up. Both Manning and Faulkner played with Cheap Trick, as we talked about, JM. Mm-hmm. Manning toured with Beck. He was involved in this band called Moog Cookbook, which was a tribute of sorts to all those early late 60s, early 70s Moog soundtrack albums. And they did cover versions of stuff on the, or yeah. Moog, I guess, is I guess how you Moog say it. Yeah. He also did several solo albums, one of which I recommended called Land of Pure Imagination.
It's a fantastic album.
Yeah. And then he also did one called Catnip Dynamite. And he recently, he got together with Eric Dover and Tim Smith under the name Licorice Quartet and put out three EPs of pop music. Yeah. Sturmer, on the other hand, stopped really doing stuff. He did work with a Fort Worth power pop band called Sugar Bomb, and they never released.
That's a great name for a pop band.
Yeah. Interestingly, I met the guys at a coffee shop, and one of the guys took me out to the car and played me their demo tape. He's like, what do you think? Does this sound like Jellyfish? He said that to me. But somehow they got hooked up with Andy Sturmer and sent him a song, and he sent it back to them. And this is what he sent back. It's called Liquid Casanova.
Wow,
it's
about
that sounds good.
Yeah, it's really good. He also worked with the Merrymakers, which was a Swedish pop band. He worked with the Japanese pop duo called Puffy Annie Yummy. He's mainly made his living writing songs for kids shows like Teen Titans, Scooby-Doo. Most recently, this show called Marvel's Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. And I've got to play you this song. This is the most recent song from that thing. Tell me what you think of this.
When you're alone, all by yourself, with nobody left to save or help, remember to remember. You're not the things you think people say. You're beautiful and you're born that way.
That's a recent song, too. So
wow, that's great.
And goodbye, then, sleepy genie. Yeah.
And then the last thing. What else? The last thing I want to talk about, because I think, Doug, you'll dig this. He was in a band, a one-off band called L.E.O., and they released an LP called Alpaca's Orgling, and it was essentially the mastermind behind it was this guy named Blue McCauley. He mainly goes by the name Blue, and it was a tribute of sorts. It was a band who wrote songs in the vein of ELO, and he sings part. He makes a brief appearance on a song called Goodbye Innocence.
A rainy cloud.
I remember when that came out, every Jellyfish head in the world was freaking out that Andy Sturmer was singing on a pop song again. Yeah. But
well, T,
I struggled with that one. It's obviously one of your favorites, but you were scared to bring it out too early.
This is an album that I wanted to do justice to, and I still don't know if I did or not. And like I said, there's people who listened who've talked about it. And I don't necessarily think I told them anything new or we told them anything new about it, but...
No, but there's probably a whole bunch of people that knew nothing about it and that are going to really learn to enjoy it.
I hope so, because it's a remarkable piece of work. Album.
And at this time, we'll find out just how remarkable it is. I'm going to go around the room and we're going to find out everybody's rating. We're going to give a cold-hearted critic rating as though we had no feelings at all, and then we're going to give it the feelings rating. And I'm gonna start with Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
All right, well, I'm gonna go with my critics rating first. I'm gonna give it a 4.8. It is an almost flawless record. I dock it a couple of tenths in some parts. It just doesn't sound that original, like they're not really doing anything new, they're just rehashing stuff that's been done. That is a very minor critique, because what they do, while they wear their influences on their sleeve, they do the song, the influence justice, and they turn it into something new. But occasionally, every now and then, it's like, oh, did you just have to copy the Beach Boys there? Couldn't you have done something a little different? Personal rating is going to be 4 or 5. And the reason why I knock it half a point is I'm not sure I could say that the album gets better with each listen. And I've heard this album a lot. It grabbed me the first time I heard it, and I've been enjoying listening to it. This is probably the album I've listened to the most. Every now and then I like to hear something and I want to get something new out of it. And that didn't really happen with me. Still, 4 or 5.
Thank you, Jonathan J. Amro. I'm going to go next since I'm not Tony. This album is the best example of why it's fun to do this show. It's fun to talk about the albums that you know and love, but it's even more fun to learn that you love an album you've never heard before. That's what happened here. I'm going to give my personal, I'm going to give it a 4 or 5 also. The only thing that keeps me from going higher is there's a lot of subjects on this album that I'm not compelled to, I don't get wrapped up in it. 4 or 5 is a great review in my mind. It would be mostly topical, keeping me from giving it more. My critic's review surprised me. It's a 5. I came to the same conclusion I have every time I've given a 5, and that is, if this isn't a 5, then what is? I think this is pretty close to a flawless album. And when I remove my own personal preferences out of it, it's a 5.
I'm going to surprise everybody to be short. It's a 5. This is my favorite album of the 90s. One of my favorite albums of all time. Easily in my top 3 favorite albums of all time. And I think it's absolutely flawless. I don't think there's anything wrong with this. I never get bored listening to it. It surprised me how many new things I heard. I'll be honest with you, I never heard the theremin before. And then I heard it and I was like, I got to find out what that's about. And then I found the story about Brian Wilson saying, I love it. 5.
Well, thanks for letting us invade your ears with another episode of This Is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. If you know anyone who likes the long player format, please let them know about this podcast, which is available on almost all podcasting platforms. And while you're up there, leave us a review, give us some stars. We're always looking for some feedback. And you can reach us via Twitter at Tapping Vinyl, or you can visit our Facebook group page if you're so inclined. And also, if you're old school, you can email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our webpage. There you'll find links to past episodes and pictures and videos about things we've mentioned on our podcast. And you can also contact us there and tell us what albums you would like for us to review in an upcoming podcast. Next week, we'll be looking at a pop album made by a band that was known more for its alt-country stylings, Summer Teeth by Wilco.
Sun caught fire, you changed.
Our host Doug Cooper, our co-host Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe. This is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11. And why not start a fan club of your own? For This Is Vinyl Tap.